This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. An investigation by the Marshall Project and the New York Times into a private prison transportation company, USG7, examines the case of Johnny Smith, who died while being transported from Florida to Kentucky in 2011. The report, titled A Man Died in a Private Prison Van, The Company Says Not Our Problem, also delves into the quest by Smith's children to claim the $650,000 in damages awarded by a judge, and the lack of accountability from the handful of companies in the prisoner transportation industry. According to the Marshall Project, those companies have been involved in some 50 crashes and 19 deaths since 2000. Staff writers Eli Hager and Alicia Santo wrote the story. I spoke with Eli Hager about what they uncovered in their investigation. So give us a synopsis of what happened here. Essentially, a private company was transporting a prisoner to face some charges, drug charges, and he didn't make it. What happened?
Right. So there's this industry of private companies that transport people across state lines to face criminal charges in other states. And so this guy, Johnny Smith, he was father of two and a construction worker, and he was disabled, and he was facing a drug charge in Florida of possession of a single oxycodone pill. And for that, this private company transported him all the way from Kentucky, and basically when he got on the van, he was already in such bad shape because he had a number of physical ailments that they had to wheelchair him onto the van. And then one of the other inmates on the van said that he appeared to have a seizure at one point and asked for help, but that the van just kept driving because these companies kind of have a profit motive to keep driving all the time and pick up more people. And he eventually died before ever making it to Florida.
So what has the family been able to do as far as get answers for what happened to Johnny Smith and also, I guess, some kind of compensation for what happened to him?
Right. So this kind of thing happens a lot in the private prisoner transport industry. I mean, at the Marshall Project, we've found, several deaths that were just like this. We found, more than 50 escapes and more than 50 crashes and all kinds of things that happen in this industry. But there's not a lot of oversight of the industry because the companies, the vans, cross state lines. And so it's kind of a hard industry to oversee. But the one way that families can get some accountability is through lawsuits. So in this case, the Johnny Smith family sued the company, and a judge said that the company's carelessness and gross negligence had caused Mr. Smith's death. But what happened was the company kind of stopped responding to the lawsuit and eventually just kind of dissolved, and they never paid the family that money.
Now, you write about this company, USG7, the company that was transporting Smith to Florida, that it was relatively small, but it contributed dramatically to the toll of accidents and escapes. In at least five cases, prisoners suffered severe injuries, including a broken neck and crashes on board its vans, which often traveled at dangerously high speeds and late into the night, according to accident reports and interviews with employees. So, Eli, was this kind of typical for a company like this, or was this unusual to have a company involved in so many incidents with the folks that it was transporting?
It's fairly typical of the industry. Like one of the other companies in the industry that we've reported on before, it's called Prisoner Transportation Services, is responsible for five deaths that were many of them were very similar to Johnny Smith's. The thing about USG7 that we were highlighting is that they did have this track record of causing this death and causing all of these accidents and injuries, but they've kind of avoided accountability for it. That was kind of the thing that was that we were trying to point out about USG7, the way that they never paid Johnny Smith's family and some of the other people who were injured on the company's vans, and how the people who ran the company have now moved on to this other company and kind of never faced accountability for it. So that's what we were highlighting with USG7.
Are there a lot of different companies involved in this, or are there a couple of companies which have kind of almost a monopoly on the market, or is it more a situation where there are many different companies and every one of them has a different kind of record?
There used to be more. There used to be. So when we were reporting this story, we found a couple dozen of these transport companies. A lot of them were just small mom-and-pop companies that did just a few transports at a time. But now the company called Prisoner Transportation Services has kind of consolidated the industry. They merged with U.S. Corrections, which is the company that kind of came out of USG7. And so now that one company does most of the transporting, and they kind of have a full monopoly, but they have what's verging on a monopoly of the industry.
Are there any states where it isn't contracted out to private companies, where it might be the county or the state or some other agency that's involved in transporting prisoners, or is it all done through private contractors?
Well, there are certainly some states and agencies that use their own people to go pick up people, to go find people in other states and bring them back to face criminal charges. But that's very expensive because a lot of this is done by local sheriffs and local counties. And so that would be very expensive for a sheriff's office to every time they have to go find somebody with a warrant in another state to go get them and bring them back in their own van. So that's why they hire out or they hire these companies to do the work for them on the cheap. But there are some – Florida does a lot of this contracting with private companies. It's where a number of the companies are located. And but there are some parts of the country, especially in the Northeast, that don't tend to use private prisoner transport.
And it sounds like there isn't an awful lot of competition, that there aren't too many folks who are interested in getting into this business.
Yeah, it's a very tough business with a lot of liability. I mean, as you can tell, a lot of these deaths have happened on these vans. As I said before, we found, over 50 crashes that have caused injuries on these vans, 60 escapes of prisoners due to the lack of training of the officers and kind of the haphazard nature with which they make stops and drive around the country, as well as over a dozen alleged sexual assaults on the vans. So so all of these things happening makes it kind of a hard – I mean, it's a costly industry to get into to make money in, and you also face a lot of liability, or at least that's the track record of the companies that are in the business now.
And as you point out in the article, the companies tend to try and pack as many people into these vans as possible. And it's pretty disturbing reading about the way you might have folks who are violent offenders transported alongside people who this would be their first time in the criminal justice system. So that is going to cause some problems.
Right. So just to give you a sense of how a typical trip would look, you could get picked up on one side of the country and be on one of these vans for up to a few weeks. We've definitely heard from inmates who were, on the same van for a couple weeks at a time because the vans go on zigzagging routes, picking people up and dropping people off. And on the vans, as you say, you can be a first-time offender, in there for a probation violation, and you could be next to somebody who's convicted of murder or, rape. And men and women are both on the van. There's no seat belts, but you are shackled at the wrists, waist, and ankles, so you're kind of bouncing around like a pinball as these vans drive at high speeds. They don't stop very often, so one very common thing is that people have to, urinate in plastic bottles and sometimes defecate in the van as well. They don't get a lot of food, and it's often dark and with little ventilation back there. And you're just sitting upright for days and days on end, so you can't really get any sleep. So that's kind of the conditions of being on one of the vans.
It sounds kind of horrifying. So what kind of rights do prisoners have in these situations? Are some of those rights being violated? And I guess what recourse do they have to try and, make things better for folks being transported across the country from one Department of Corrections to the other?
Well, they might not even be being transported between Departments of Corrections. I mean, they might just be faced – they might not have been convicted of anything yet. They might just have an open warrant in another state that they're going to be transported to the court in that other state to go face it. So that's an important note. But in terms of their rights, I mean, they have civil rights under the Constitution against cruel and unusual punishment, of course, and those are the grounds that they often bring lawsuits under. But there's just not a lot of accountability for the industry as a whole. There is one federal law that sets some basic safety standards for prisoners on interstate prisoner transportation, but it's only been enforced by the Justice Department one time since it was enacted in 2000, despite, you know, these dozens and dozens of crashes and escapes and deaths and other abuses. There's not a lot of oversight of the industry. And as I said before, since the vans are crossing state and county lines all the time, different jurisdictions can kind of pass off responsibility for things that happen because they, you know, they can say, well, that happened in your county or that happened in your county. And so kind of falls into a gray area.
Shouldn't it just be something that's regulated at the federal level then?
Right. Well, so that's the intention of this law, which is called GINA's Act. But like I said, it's only been enforced one time by the Department of Justice. And then the Federal Department of Transportation also oversees prisoner transport companies in the same way that it would for other kinds of passenger carriers. But we did a public records request of the Department of Transportation, and it looked like, based on records of their audits, that the audits are not that frequent, and that there hasn't been a lot of fines levied against prisoner transport companies, despite their often failing to have records and having lots of crashes and that kind of thing. So they kind of get off the hook.
So Eli Hager, what's your sense of what happens to the prisoner transportation industry from here on out? Is there going to be more scrutiny on it? Are there some folks, on Capitol Hill or even state level lawmakers who are looking into this and making noise about it?
Yes, there are. After we published at the Marshall Project our original investigation of the private prisoner transport industry, which was back in 2016, the U.S. Attorney General at that time, Loretta Lynch, was asked about the article in a hearing of the House of Representatives Judiciary Committee, and she promised to investigate the industry. And so that probe at the DOJ may be ongoing. And then also recently, two Democratic presidential candidates, Cory Booker and Elizabeth Warren, along with Congressman Ted Deutch, who's from Florida, sent a letter to Prisoner Transportation Services, which is one of the largest company in the industry, demanding documents about their practices because of their record of deaths and abuses. So there definitely are people on Capitol Hill who are aware of what's going on.
And back to the family of Johnny Smith, what does the outlook look like for them? Are they likely to recover any of what was awarded to them by that judge?
It seems unlikely because, obviously it's now been 8 years since the death and about half that time since the end of the lawsuit, and the company nor its insurance company has ever paid the nearly $650,000 that they're supposed to owe this family. And so it looks like they essentially don't have any recourse, and that's why we're deciding to write about them. And the other important thing to note is that the two brothers who were essentially the operations managers of the company USG7, where Johnny Smith died, they went on to create another company, and they now own part of PTS, the largest company in the country. And so they're still out there, but they personally haven't faced accountability for this death.
Are you going to keep writing about the industry? Is it something that the Marshall Project is going to keep looking into?
Well, I mean, as long as we keep finding kind of new instances of these things going on, and as long as it seems like these patterns of abuses on the vans and deaths continue to happen on these vans, we think it's a newsworthy subject that people should know about. So, yes, we will.
Eli Hager is one of the staff writers for a piece published by the Marshall Project and the New York Times about prison transportation. Thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks again for having me.
And the title of that investigation from the Marshall Project and the New York Times, A Man Died in a Private Prison Van, the company says, not our problem. Up next, the psychology of time management. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The key to time management is psychological. That's according to psychotherapist and counsellor Dr. Linda DeRay. DeRay says her father was like a Marine Corps drill sergeant. She had to pass room inspection until the age of 18. She says that upbringing taught her how to be organised and get more done with her day. Next week, DeRay will host a couple of time management seminars at the Winter Park Public Library. DeRay stopped by the WMFE studio to talk about how to make the most out of your day. Well, Linda DeRay, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Matthew.
So what's the first thing you tell people about how to manage their time?
The first thing is that most people feel out of control. They feel overwhelmed. They have lost all hope, and they just give up. So the first key is psychological. It's to feel that you're in control of your life and your decisions, and that you are going to get as much done as possible because you have motivation to do so.
What got you interested in time management? Like, how did this become a thing that you wanted to tell other people about?
Well, you know the expression, we teach what we need to learn? I think that's very true. Some people have said, you know, you do more in a day than most people do in a week. Other people have said, you do more in a week than most people do in a month. I know how to manage time. I'm not saying you'll necessarily be on time for it, but you'll get more done.
How did you learn how to manage your time?
I had a father who was like a Marine Corps drill sergeant, and there were no excuses. My childhood was like growing up at Camp Lejeune. So it was get this done. I had to pass room inspection till I was 18 years old, or I couldn't go out for a date or a dance. And don't get me wrong, he was a very good man in many, many ways. And I learned discipline, and I learned how to push myself and go the extra mile and remember things and make lists. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget, he used to buy me a schedule book because he knew that I needed to get a hold of my time. And that was his gift to me. So I'm very grateful for that from him. And I had a wonderful mother, and, you know, she wasn't like that. But it was great discipline. I really learned how to get things done.
Did you go away to college?
I certainly did.
And did you live in a dorm, or were you rooming with people?
First time I was in a dorm, I was president of my dorm, Morrison Tower. And then I transferred to California to Pacific Oaks College, which was the only school at the time that had a human development major. And it was founded by Quakers in the 40s. And it was a combination of upper division, junior and senior year only, and a children's school, which were all on the same grounds in those days. Mm-hmm. So that you'd go to classes in human development, psychology, child growth, et cetera, and then you would work your internship in the children's schools. So you could be in a two-year-old yard with the two-year-olds, or three-year-olds, four-year-olds, and then they had a kindergarten. And it was just one of the best schools ever. It was like the Harvard of early childhood education in those days. Mm-hmm. Now it's a different story in terms of it was bought by a corporation, and it's very different now. But in those days, you literally could go, Bob, hi, could I have a minute with you? I just need to ask you a few questions. And he was the president of the school. Mm-hmm. Or you'd go to the dean of students and you'd go, knock, knock, knock. Hi, B, I'd just like to ask you a couple questions. And come on in. That was the way it was. It was so wonderful, so cohesive, so loving, so warm, and very, very focused on what you were supposed to learn. So it was a great education.
So with a degree in hand, was psychotherapy what you gravitated towards, or where did that fit into the picture?
Well, I love teaching little kids. So I taught in Head Start in Pasadena, which I loved, and I taught nursery school, and I have 3 K through 6 teaching credentials, New York, New Jersey, California. So I came back to I also was in a training program, by the way, at Caltech. Mm-hmm. For training people to do therapy groups for the people at Caltech, the students. So they picked 3 women and 3 men, and I was fortunate enough to make the cut. And so they taught us group techniques to just have, you know, sharing. It was not like we were licensed, but we had weekly supervision and that was by two psychologists. And it was great to really learn that. And mm-hmm. I always knew that I was going to get my PhD. I thought initially maybe I would get my MD and be a pediatrician, but I found that I faint at the sight of blood, so I thought it might be a deterrent to a career in medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me anything, just don't bleed.
You've done a number of things, though, right? You've done marriage and family counseling. You've worked with businesses. You've worked with sports people and teams as well. Is time management kind of a theme that runs through all of the things you worked on?
That's a great question, and that is absolutely true. Because if you don't have control of your time, you're not going to get things done. And if you don't get things done, you're not going to make money and you're not going to serve people and provide good services and good products. So this comes from the CEO down to the guys on the dock and the receptionist. You have to be in control of your time. And you only get 24 hours in a day. That's all anybody gets. So at least six of that should be for sleep.
Is that enough?
No, but that's what I ran on when I was in graduate school. I was up at 6 and in bed usually by 12 or 1,
mm-hmm.
and I did that for 4 years. I had three part-time jobs. I worked in a mental hospital, a psychiatric hospital. I taught and tutored little children and teenagers after school and on weekends, and then I worked in an agency for San Diego County that had a they had a contract with San Diego County. And then I worked for an agency that had a contract with San Diego County to handle and do therapy with felons and guys on probation and parole.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved it all. I mean, it was just great. I mean, my parents were lovely middle-class parents, but they couldn't exactly write checks for $20,000 every semester, you know. So when you have a dream and you want to get your goals accomplished, you do whatever it takes, ethically, morally, and legally to accomplish your goals. And that's what I did.
A lot of creative people maybe aren't so good at managing their time. Is there a connection between creative people who are able to succeed and those who maybe aren't so successful in the way they keep control of their day, so to speak?
It's sort of the difference between left and right brain thinking. Left brain thinking is very logical, rational, orderly, lawyers, doctors, engineers, mathematicians, accountants, you know, bookkeepers,
mm-hmm.
very left brain. And then right brain people are more nonlinear. They're creative. They think out of the box. That's the kind of energy that right brain people think. And both energies are crucial to this planet.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're an artist, you know, find somebody who's managing your studio, who makes the appointments and keeps you on time and manages your schedule and all of that. I think that's absolutely incredible. I think a lot of times people clash with a different type of thinking when you should make friends with it. I mean, this is a planet of polarity. So
mm-hmm. it certainly is.
If you don't know how to get along with the polar opposites, you're going to have a tough time.
Linda DeRay, are you left brain or right brain?
I hopefully think I'm a good combination of both. So when I need to do left brain stuff, I can do that. When I need to do right brain stuff, my last painting sold for $1,200. So I'm proud to announce that I am also an artist, and I love painting in my spare time, and I write. I've had poems published. I've written, I think, about 8 screenplays and about 15 different treatments. I sold a television series to Aaron Spelling when I was 22. I joined the Writers Guild. I also act. I'm a member of SAG-AFTRA mm-hmm. and ASCAP. I'm also a lyricist. I've written with about 5 or 6 different songwriters. And it's a nice balance for me. And I love doing therapy and I love giving speeches. And I've been a corporate consultant and trainer for Fortune 500 companies. And my book, Surviving the Toxic Workplace, was published by McGraw-Hill. And the subtitle is Protect Yourself Against the Coworkers, Bosses, and Work Environments That Poison Your Day.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, I took all my life experience of working for people who were not so nice and putting that into a book about how to deal with them psychologically.
So you got quite a few strings to your bow. And you spent a lot of time in California immersed in the world of show business and other things. Tell me more about that.
Right. Since I was 18, I've had two careers, as I told you. I've had psychology and entertainment. And they go hand in hand beautifully because people will say if they read one of my scripts, wow, you really know how to write dialogue. Well, what do you think I've been doing for all these years? I've been sitting in an office listening to how people talk and cry and complain and try to get their marriages together or fight or deal with difficult children or drug problems or, you know, whatever. So it works beautifully in terms of it's synergistic, in my opinion.
Before we got started, you were showing me you have two phones. You spend a bit of time still in California. You maintain ties there as well.
Absolutely.
I'm wondering, though, I mean, the smartphone and thinking about time management, you know, smartphones tend to kind of dominate our lives these days, right? Are you the master of your devices, or do you find that they control you a little bit?
Well, as I said to you while we were prepping, I have to get it in the phone because I don't want to forget anything. And I find that if these phones, you know, if this phone was a man, I'd marry it. I'm in love with it. So there you go with phones. But I think they're fabulous. I'm a giant fan of tech. And I send an email and I feel like Sir Edmund Hillary climbing Mount Everest, you know. It's not exactly my area of expertise, but I love it. Mm-hmm. And I think you do have to be in control of it. And I think you do have to turn it off. And I think the other thing that drives me crazy is that parents allow their children to bring cell phones to the dinner table. That's not what I would do if I were a mother.
Because you have kids who come to the time management seminars you run, right? I mean,
right.
So that's one of the things you tell them, leave that phone somewhere else.
That's exactly right. And I've done time management workshops for God knows how many years. And the ones that I did a year or so ago, a couple of them for Winter Park Public Library, were for teenagers. And I got some wonderful comments from the parents. And they said, I don't know what you said in that seminar, but she's keeping her room clean. Or she came back and she's on time for things. And I don't have to, you know, I don't have to pull her out of bed in the morning. Or they're all organized at night and they're finishing their homework. And that's the kind of comments that make my day, that they get what time management is all about. Because if you don't control your clock with your schedule, you're going to fritter away the day. You're going to forget things. You're not going to be able to accomplish your goals and your dreams. That's always been a big priority for me. And I want to do that with my clients when they come in and they say, I want to accomplish this. Well, let's see how we can do that. So I give a lot of homework since I've taught at Rollins and Stetson and Valencia and Seminole. And I give, you know, good assignments and books to read and websites so you can accelerate the therapy.
There's a bit of a craze right now for tidying things up physically, right? And it sort of goes back to Marie Kondo and her Netflix series, her book as well. Is there a connection between physical tidiness and being mentally tidy or keeping your time, things to do in the right space?
I absolutely believe that. What you need to do is get rid of stuff that doesn't work or doesn't fit. You know, give it to Goodwill or bring it to a church charity or sell it in a garage sale. You know, when you make room for new things, it allows the universe, call it God, Jesus, Buddha, Krishna, George Lucas, the Force, whatever you want to call it, to come in and give you what you need, what you ask for. But you have to get the waste or what's not working anymore out of the picture. And I'm a firm believer in recycling.
And is it the same thing for time, though? I mean, do you have to push aside the things that are taking up time and not giving you value and
absolutely,
allow yourself more time for stuff that is valuable?
Absolutely. And that's beautifully put. I also think that where there's a will, there's a lot of greedy relatives. No, when there's a will, there's a way. And I think the issue is you make the time. I read a story about a woman who got up at 5 o'clock every morning. She wrote from 5 to 7. She got ready, and she left for work and came back. And after the kids were asleep, she wrote for 2 more hours and then went to bed. And she had a bestseller done in a year. And that's how she wrote her book, because she had it in her.
So, Linda DeRay, what do people need to know if they want to come to one of the seminars you're running on time management?
Time management. There are 2 seminars. It's at the Winter Park Public Library. They will be Thursday night, April 11th, from 6 to 8 p.m., and Saturday, April 13th, from 2 to 4 p.m. I have a PowerPoint presentation to make. And since I've done stand-up on open mic nights at the Comedy Store on Sunset in L.A. and at the Improv in Los Angeles, I tell a lot of jokes. So I like to keep it light and have fun, and I like people to learn. It's also open to teenagers, so anyone from 12 years old through adulthood, they're welcome, and it's free. The operative word is free, and they do have to register. And they can also, you know, show up at the last minute if they fail to register.
Presumably you want people to be on time for it too, right?
Well, it would sort of be conducive with the theme of the presentations.
Well, you can find some more details about Linda's time management seminars on our website, wmfe.org. Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you, and God bless.
Up next on Intersection, what does the future hold? Joe Tankersley might not be able to predict the future, but he can help you plan for it. A conversation about futurism and how to think more positively about what's over the horizon. That's when Intersection returns in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Amid political turmoil, environmental challenges, and eroding trust in democratic institutions, the future can look pretty bleak. But Joe Tankersley says it could be a lot brighter than people imagine, and he's on a mission to persuade people to change the way they think about the future. Joe Tankersley is the author of Reimagining Our Tomorrows, Making Sure Your Future Doesn't Suck. Joe Tankersley, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Matt.
First of all, I want to start by asking about what a futurist is. Now, you're a futurist. For the layperson, what does a futurist do?
That question gets asked all the time, of course.
Sure.
The real role of a futurist is to help organizations think more proactively about what might be coming. It's not about predicting the future. It's about understanding the trends today and what they might turn into, say, in the next 10, 15, 20 years. If you're forewarned, then you have the ability to begin thinking more progressively about what you want to do. So the future doesn't surprise you. You get to shape more of the future.
Do all big companies have a futurist or somebody who has that kind of role? Like, if you're a bigger company, you're probably there's more need for making sure things don't go off the rails down the track, whether it's 10 years down or 20 years down.
Yeah, futures started actually with the RAND Corporation in governments. They were the first folks to start thinking about this. And then most big companies at least have somebody they bring in from time to time to help them think about the future. What we're starting to see now is how do we spread that to, say, local governments and community groups so that everybody can be better able to understand what might be coming.
So like city commissions, et cetera, that they might have a futurist who they would check in with from time to time?
I don't know many cities that have a futurist on staff. I've done some work with some of the local city commissions in this area, helping them just think as they start a new, particularly after a new group has been elected, think about what the main priorities are and what they want to think about. So they'll react to somebody. There are a few large nonprofits that actually have futurists on staff. The American Museum Association has an entire group of futurists that work with them.
That's ironic, isn't it? Obviously, a lot of museums have exhibitions dedicated to the past, right? So it's kind of interesting they might have a futurist on staff.
Yeah, for them, obviously, the future is one of those things that holds both opportunity and a lot of challenge because they're seeing how the traditional museum is no longer as popular as it used to be.
Right.
So they look at it for 2 things. One is, how do we think differently about how we present information about the past? And secondly, is there a different story we should be telling? In fact, there's a group meeting in, I believe, September in Toronto, where I'll be working with a group of folks to talk about how museums can tell stories about the future.
Mm-hmm. Have you done some work with museums?
I've worked with the Museum Association a couple of times. They actually did some interesting work a couple of years ago where they wanted to encourage people to create stories about the future of museums. And so I was one of the judges that helped them understand and help, you know, evaluate those stories and help teach people how do you tell stories about the future.
Mm-hmm. Museums have gotten a lot more interactive, haven't they? I think they've borrowed quite a bit from what theme parks do, really immerse people in an experience. So I imagine there's something of that might come into what a futurist might be talking to a museum about.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The theme parks became a huge unexpected form of competition for the museums, particularly places like Epcot that provided some sort of education and entertainment. So museums have fought back by becoming more immersive. You'll see a lot of use of virtual reality and augmented reality in museums today. That's their attempts to get ahead of the curve.
Mm-hmm. So, Joe Tankersley, how did you become a futurist?
That's a long story. I'll try and make it relatively short. I've always been passionate about the future. My background is really a storyteller. And I started working at Disney in 1996 at Imagineering, working on projects at Epcot. And mm-hmm. so that, to me, was really exciting to think about the future. I went to my first World Future Society conference back then. I got Disney to send me to that. And I was really disappointed, because there were all of these guys with projectors and slides and, at that time, overhead transparencies, and they made the
future. Man, that's not very futuristic.
It's not, and they made the future seem really boring, and I knew that wasn't right. So for me, it was really interesting to think about how, as a storyteller, I could change that. Then sort of fast forward a couple of years, I was working on 100 Years of Magic, an exhibit many people around here know, reading about the history of Walt's life. And I came across a quote from Ray Bradbury where he referred to Walt as an optimistic futurist. And I realized that's what I want to be when I grow up, mm-hmm. that idea of using positive stories to get people to think differently about the future.
Did it take you a while to figure out what your role in life was going to be, kind of find your niche?
That was my third or fourth different career at that point in time. Yeah, I've tried a bunch of different things as I've gone through it. And then once I discovered that, of course, it took me a few years at Disney to convince them that they needed an in-house futurist. I did a lot of explaining as to what futures were and finally sort of brought them back to their history, which was that's what a lot of what Walt did, both entertainment and otherwise.
Mm-hmm. So you were Disney's first in-house futurist?
I wasn't actually the first one. I was Walt Disney Imagineering's first in-house futurist. The Disney company, about the same time, had started some futures group in the human resources group. A young woman there who continues to work as a futurist here in Orlando started that group, and I did some work with them and worked with some of the other parts of the company. So I was involved in the future of workforce, the future of social capital, and, of course, the future of creativity.
Mm-hmm. I guess Epcot, it's a theme park, but it sort of started out with a slightly more lofty vision, right? Experimental Prototype Community of Tomorrow, I think, is what it stands for. Is it your favorite theme park out of the Disney parks?
I have to say it probably is, just because of that history and what it was supposed to be. The challenge was that they built a bunch of huge buildings that had to last for 30 years, and the future caught up with them and got ahead of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the lessons that I think we learned from that, is you can't create a static vision of the future. But I always have a soft spot, you know, for Epcot.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the fact that those rides do seem a bit dated. I like the... That's what I like about them myself. So back in 1996, when you were getting into sort of figuring out what a futurist was and saying, I want to be one of those, what did the future look like? Because we're now, 2019, some visions of the future are pretty bleak. 1996, what did it look like to you then?
Well, of course, 1996 was when the internet was going to change everything, and we were all going to live online, and it was going to be incredibly democratic.
We do kind of live online now.
Well, we do. You know, some of the promise I think we've lost in terms of the unexpected fact that there's still some very large corporate entities who control our lives online.
Mm-hmm.
And it's gotten darker since then. The digital boom and bust sort of, I think, had an impact on that. Some other things have affected us. Right now, we're living in a very dark vision of the future, and that's one of the things that concerns me. I think mm-hmm. we need to change that attitude.
Right, and that's the subtitle of your book, Making Sure Your Future Doesn't Suck. So what are some of the things from the book? What is your prescription for making sure that 20 years from now we are not living in an even bleaker version of the future?
Well, the first thing is you have to understand that we have more agency to create the future than we give ourselves credit, particularly in the digital age that we live in. So we have to understand that we don't need to be waiting for someone else to create the future for us. The second thing is that we have to change the stories we tell ourselves about the future. We tend to think of the future as being more or less of today. What really is happening is we're moving through a phase where the digital world that we live in is going to create major disruptions, and we have the chance to completely reconceptualize. What does it mean to work? What does it mean to have a democracy? What is a community's role? Those are some of the things, the conversations we need to have. So for me, the very first thing is start having the conversation. Mm-hmm. Start thinking about different ways to think about the future, and then we can begin to create a future that's more equitable, that's more abundant, that is also more sustainable. I think those are the three things we need to focus on.
There are some things that are going to have to be taken care of, though, right? I mean, a lot of people are looking at things now and saying, we're worried about, for example, the climate. What's the world going to look like 50 years from now? You know, is it going to be a place that my grandchildren or great-grandchildren will want to grow up?
There is no question that we face real problems. And one of the challenges I have as an optimistic futurist is people believing that I think we're going to create a utopia. We're not. The future will always be messy. The past was always messy. Mm-hmm. What I think is that we have some new tools to address some of these problems. Climate change is a perfect example. In the last 10 years, the ability to use renewable energy sources has just skyrocketed. We're seeing exponential growth in that ability. We can solve some of that problem by moving to new energy sources. We can solve some of the problem by thinking about new ways to consume items, eliminating a lot of the waste that we create today, and we have that technology. But it's not all technology. It'd also be thinking differently about how do we consume, how do we live, how do we move around in the future. We're going to suffer consequences of climate change. We already are. But I think we can, if we're positive and look for opportunities, we can make those negative impacts less. That's my vision of the future.
Mm-hmm. Are you out on a limb a bit as a futurist? Are there still kind of different schools of thought for futurists? Are there some who are like, we can't sugarcoat this, we've got to tell everybody what the grim news is before we get to some of the good stuff?
There's certainly a strong trend toward dystopian futures, particularly in the popular media. That's where you see most of that. I'm not out on the limb. If you look at people like the folks at something called the Singularity University, Ray Kurzweil and that group in California, they are completely over the top in my mind and thinking about what the positive future is going to be, and it's all going to be rosy and great, and technology is going to make us free. Mm-hmm. I'm the guy who sits in the middle and sort of says, it's not as bad as you think it is. It could be better. There are going to be some problems. And in some ways, that's a difficult message for people because they like black or white. They like, mm-hmm. you know, it's going to be terrible. It's going to be great.
And is it a challenge for you, especially if people say, look, you're a futurist. Tell me what the world is going to be like in 20 years from now. Is that kind of challenging? How do you kind of get around that?
Well, the first thing, of course, is that I can't tell you exactly what the world's going to look like. I can't predict the future. No good futurist will do that. What I can do is help you think about what the different possibilities are. There are some things that are pretty obvious. This country's getting older. We're going to have to think about what that means. The impact of climate change is going to increase in the next few years. We're going to have to deal with some of these big problems. Those things are obvious. What I do is offer people alternatives that challenge their imagination, mm-hmm. Different ways to think about what would a future look like where we really reimagined aging, for instance. What would a future look like where we took this idea of the gig economy and turned it on its head and said, hey, let's make that work for people. Let's not make that something that just works for business. And by challenging them, what I want them to do is create their own visions of the future.
Do you think, Joe, in Florida, we're sort of ahead of the curve a little bit because some of the things you talk about, you know, the challenges of climate change, the fact that we do have an aging population. Florida has been dealing with that for some time now anyway because a lot of people, you know, retire to Florida. So we have maybe more folks who are, you know, the baby boomers and beyond moving to Florida. People have to figure out, like, the best way for folks that age and older to live their best life here in Florida and deal with some of the challenges they might have of getting around, even getting back into the workforce. I mean, you mentioned the gig economy, too. Mm-hmm. So does Florida have an opportunity here that maybe other states in the United States don't have because we do have some of these challenges up front?
Yeah, we're gonna get to that future about a decade before everyone else. And so we should be the leader in reimagining what aging looks like. We haven't done a great job so far, to be honest with you. There are some places like St. Petersburg, which are creating walkable downtown areas, which turn out to be incredibly important for an aging population and everyone else. So that's a great approach. We're still dealing with a lot of denial in terms of imagining that us boomers aren't going to get old. We just don't believe it yet. So one of my that's my personal passion right now, obviously, because I am a boomer. I want to help people really start that conversation. I'd love to see Florida lead the way toward reimagining aging in the future. I think we've got the right resources to do it and the right problems.
Some of those things as well, you know, the gig economy, off the top of your head, or maybe not off the top of your head, since you're a futurist, you've been thinking about this. How do you turn that around? Because a lot of the stories you read, a lot of the headlines are about the fact that it's benefiting maybe some corporations and the folks who are actually working in the gig economy are finding it's not as good as they thought it might be.
Right, absolutely. Right now, the gig economy is an excuse to cut off benefits to workers, to only have people on your payroll when you absolutely need them. If you project that out, though, and you think about what happens in 10 or 15 years, particularly with the technical tools that are available to people, what I suspect may happen is we'll see a turnaround. Suddenly, all of the gig workers are going to start to go, why do I need to even have a gig? Why am I not just doing this on my own? Let me explain that in more specifics. Take Uber, for example. The idea behind Uber is because of a piece of software, you know, you can get a ride whenever you want to, and I have a job whenever you need me. What we're already seeing is direct peer-to-peer car sharing. Who needs Uber? If you've got a car and I know how to contact you and I can work out an arrangement with you, and that means we don't have that middleman anymore. So that's really the future of this idea of the gig economy. It's really peer-to-peer economy. And that gives individuals more power. Now, the problem is individuals have to know how to collaborate. So we have to teach them how to be better entrepreneurs and how to work better together. But there are some huge opportunities there, I think, to make the gig economy the real future of work. The interesting thing in terms of the gig economy is the growth of co-working spaces. You know, WeWork is an excellent example of that. They've grown from being a very small startup to being a major corporation that's now talking about how they are part of your life, every part of your life, so that you have tribes like WeWork coming along in the future where you can actually be part of a WeWork corporation of sorts, do the work as an independent contractor, but use other facilities and other connections that they provide you, and suddenly, once again, you're much more powerful than you were as an individual. You know, that's their model for the future.
Is there anything that you look at and you say, even for myself as an optimistic futurist, this is pretty bad? I can't really put a positive spin on it.
It is tough, I think, to put a positive spin on the short term right now, because there's so much negativity going on, and there are so many difficult problems that we have to change the way we talk about them. So I imagine that the next few years are going to be rocky. I see short-term being tough. I am always optimistic about the longer term, but we're going to have to figure out different ways to think about some things, or we will not make these changes.
Well, Joe Tankersley is the author of Reimagining Our Tomorrows, Making Sure Your Future Doesn't Suck. Joe, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you, Matt. I really appreciate it.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Listener support is our biggest source of fundraising. With your help, we're able to produce the in-depth reporting and thoughtful conversations that you hear on Intersection and elsewhere on 90.7. The money we raise from this fund drive will sustain us until the fall. So make a contribution by calling 1-800-785-2020 or by clicking wmfe.org/support. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Ashley Garrett. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.